So I'm Malaysian, I'm first generation. I came when I was 10 with my older brother and my parents.
In this episode of the Level Asian podcast, we're chatting to Zoe Lowe, General Manager of July.
I guess I didn't see a lot of Asian women around me succeed and be in management roles. So when you don't see something, you don't really know that it's possible. When we migrated and I kind of traveled a bit more, I started to see women in leadership roles, women of color in leadership roles, which made a huge difference. That is how it started for me, being like, well, if she can do it, I can do it too. Having diverse ways of leading is now very widely accepted and encouraged.
Strong leadership is kind of like what you see in the army, right? Like you've got this strong male with power that's commanding over people and yelling. They use that a bit in corporate as well. I am the younger generation, so I'm starting to understand that that doesn't really work with us. We're so much more in tune with our emotions. I don't think a leader should be just strong and not being in tune with the emotions with their team.
I think you can be both emotionally in tune and emotionally intelligent and stoic at the same time. My assumption growing up was if you cry and you show strong displays of emotion, you're weak. It's actually stronger for you to face your emotions head on. So Asian for me to say this. It's so efficient. Because otherwise, you'll have to deal with it maybe 5-10 years down the track.
Yeah, and it's all
done now.
Before we get started on today's episode, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded, the land of the Darug people. We would like to acknowledge and pay respects to our elders past and present and the next generation coming through. Now, onto today's episode.
So what was the digital nomad life for you?
Okay, back then it was not as popular as it is now. So yeah, it's like quite, it didn't exist, unknown. Right? Yeah, I don't know when you did it, but I did
2019.
It. 2019. Yeah, so I did it 2015.
Whoa, you did it early.
Yeah, really early. Long story short, okay. I met my now husband at work and then he was like, I'm leaving to go and travel, but work at the same time. Like I'll contract while I'm overseas. Do you want to come? And I said, what? Like I had no idea what he was talking about. So he explained the whole concept, which is, you know, you work digitally, so you don't need to be in one place. Obviously now that's so common after COVID. And he said, why don't you come? And we'd been dating maybe maybe 6 months. And like any young, crazy 20-year-old, I was like, yeah, of course, I'll come with you. And so I like, quit my job, sold, then started to get some clients and I contracted doing social and content marketing while I traveled with him. So that's how it started. And right. It was great. We went to Bali.
Of course.
Yeah.
Like Aussie.
It was really soft entry into the lifestyle because my parents were living there at the time as well.
Your parents were living in Bali?
Yeah. So my parents, I have really hippie parents actually. Wow. Yeah. So my dad is like a bamboo architect. So he specializes in sustainable buildings made out of bamboo.
Okay.
And so he was doing that there and mum was living with him obviously. And so we were like, why not we join? And then we start there and then see where we go. And then the whole plan was to do it for like a year and a half. And then it kind of went south a little bit because we broke up.
Okay.
In Hong Kong. So we traveled, like we did a few Asian cities and then we broke up in Hong Kong. I came back to Melbourne. He did too. And then we stayed broken up for the total of 1 month.
And then you got back together.
And then we got back together.
Oh, you're made for each other.
Yeah, I think that was when we knew that we were made for each other.
Yeah.
Because you make the decision. Everyone has different philosophies on this, but I think it's really nice to have like an exit clause in a relationship after a certain amount of time. And then if you actually choose after a mini breakup to come back together, you're actually making a far more considered informed decision. So because you already know what they're like, whereas at the start you don't, and then you could feel stuck and resentful. But when we made the decision to get back together, it was very like we actually knew each other quite well, so we were like, this is it.
You were very clear that you guys were made for each other in the sense that
I didn't know until we'd broken up and had a lot of time to think, like, you know someone's full strengths, all their weaknesses. And then I was like, this is it. Like I think we balance each other out really well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can relate to that. Distance makes the heart grow fonder. I actually, with my missus, I'm not sure you knew that we were on and off for quite a long time.
No, too. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
early on?
I would say that we dated for like about 6 months and I can't even remember because we were like mates and we're workmates. then became mates.
Yeah.
And then became more than mates. Then became like, all right, let's do it. Girlfriend, boyfriend. Saw each other for a little while. And then we're like, you know what? This is just too much. And we kind of like stopped.
For yeah. 6 months?
It wasn't 6 months. It was just like, I don't even know when it was. It was weird because like, it was so on and off all the time. So one moment I'm like, yeah, I don't think we should do this. And then the next moment she's like, yeah, I don't like you as much as I thought I did. Yeah. So it just kept going. Yeah. And then after a while, we still kept talking to each other. We still came back to each other. Every time there was like a tough time in our life, we'd always confide in each other. So we kind of realized, you know what? Like we've seen enough people. We don't have that many relationships, but we've made relationships. We've started relationships and we realized that, you know what? We're the one. You're the
same
one.
As you?
Yeah, similar.
Yeah.
I just think when I was younger, I thought it'd be a lot more linear. You know, you date, you get engaged and you get married.
It's like a fairy tale.
Time to say second best.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, that's what you think. But yep. I actually think the beauty of it is when you accept that things don't have to be linear. There is no conventional thing. And sometimes the best part of relationships come out through, well, a lot of the times the best ones come out of adversity and going through things like breakups and really traumatic things together. So,
Like the time where I had to pick her up when she was drunk and didn't know what was going on, vomiting everywhere.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
Times like that. Yeah. Right? You're talking about that, right?
Not quite, but still a bonding experience. That is still a bonding experience.
Who's adversity, huh?
Yeah. So yours. Much adversity.
Hey, my car.
Never
my
the car same again.
So you said you were doing marketing whilst you were traveling?
Yes.
So that's your background, isn't it?
Yes, marketing? It was. Okay. It is. And it is my foundation skill set, yes.
Right. And you were, I believe you said you were working in tech, sort of in your previous life, so to speak.
Yes. So we met each other at CoinJar.
Yep.
They were very lucky. Sorry, they were very nice. And I was very fortunate that they let me leave the full-time role but contract while I was overseas.
Oh, okay.
So they enabled the digital nomad life,
right?
Which was amazing.
They were quite progressive then, I imagine.
Very. I mean, the crypto in 2014, really.
Yeah, that wasn't even mainstream.
It was crazy. Yeah, I don't even know I know, but it's kind of crazy how I ended up there because especially now being in a luggage brand. Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah,
it's went from something really different to, usually people would probably, I imagine it would flip the other way, like because of crypto being so big now, well, sort of come down a little bit, but like moved into places like this, whereas you left it and then you like moved into.
And then I went back again. Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, so like we just spoke about not things not being linear. And I would say when I look back, and I'm only like what, 10, 12 years into my career, so very short time, but yeah, it has been very non-linear. So the story is I did well at school. I was very academic, but I wanted to do a course that didn't require a grade enter, which was a Bachelor of Communication. Then I entered it and it was actually a personality entry. You have to do an in-person interview and that's how you get in.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, that's how you get into the course.
Okay.
So I got in, did it, got a graduate role at WorkSafe, which is a government agency, and they do, you know, the rotations like any other grad program. I did it and I was quite miserable.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out why. I was pretty much got to a point where I was crying after work every day and I was like, I was so frustrated. I was like, maybe I don't really know why. And I think I finally figured out it was because I was extremely bored and so frustrated about being bored. In hindsight, it makes perfect sense. Mm. I enrolled into a evening classes that I paid for myself for digital marketing, which at that time was quite newish coming up. And I started looking for different roles. And there was all this other stuff that happened. I fell in love with this guy in Malaysia and I tried to leave Australia to go and be with him. Yeah, it was complicated. But you know, while I was catching up with a friend one day, he said, hey, why don't you try joining a startup? And it never occurred to me because that's not really something they talk to you in your careers counselor when you're in high school. And he said, oh, there's a startup that I know called CoinJar and they're looking for a digital marketing junior. You could probably do it. Do you want an intro? And I said, what do they do? Oh, they like, you know, they're a crypto platform, Bitcoin platform back then. Mm. And I was like, what's Bitcoin? And so I went down this huge rabbit hole. I went to, you know, the founder was doing a talk. So I did like a little research, like a recon session. And I went to his talk. And then I did the interview and I said, look, like, let's just give it a go. And I think at that time, I had actually a job offer in Malaysia, and it didn't work out, and I was very close to leaving. And so things just kind of lined up really well. Mm-hmm. And then I took that job with CoinJar, and then I just started there.
Well, what happened to the job in Malaysia?
Oh,
sorry, I was just confirming. Are you in Malaysia at this time, or are you in Australia?
No, I was here. I just fell in love with some guy in Malaysia. Oh.
So from a timeline perspective, the guy you are married to now, this was pre him,
yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. And then so you were going to consider going to Malaysia, and like what happened to the job there? Like you said,
okay.
It didn't work out.
The contract was rescinded because my security clearance wasn't granted because I'm born in Malaysia. It was a very high level job in the Australian Commission.
Oh.
And I think there was a HR screw up. It's like one of those moments where I didn't do anything wrong at all. You know, when you try so hard to make something work, I spoke like fluent Malay in my interview. I gave them my passport, which says my place of birth was Kuala Lumpur. Huh. And it's just one of those moments where I said, I tried so hard because I was so in love with this guy that I'd met in Malaysia during one of my trips home. I sold everything. So I'd quit the job, got that. And like on, so I'd gotten, I had my fail. I was just about to have my farewell party on the Saturday, and my flight was on the Monday. So I'd sold everything, packed everything up, had that awful moment with my mom where she cried and she was like, I don't want you to go. And then they called me and they said, your contract's been rescinded. And I couldn't believe it because I was like, I'd done everything. And we're so close to be, I don't know if anyone's ever been in a long distance, but when you're in a long distance relationship and you finally get to a point where you actually make it happen.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen. Oh, I was crushed.
Yeah, I bet you were.
It was really bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then the CoinJar thing worked out. So in hindsight, it makes sense. But at the time, awful, like really awful.
Yeah. I guess things happen for a reason as well.
Yes.
And how did it go with, we obviously know what happened with the relationship, but like how did it impact the relationship?
Oh yeah, we broke up. We just never got back together.
Because
like
of that.
Yeah.
Really?
It's really
like
sad.
You weren't like sort of going, he goes, oh, I'll come to Australia or you
we
go to
Malaysia.
We were
so young. We were so young. And I think when something that, we didn't fight for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is really sad. Obviously now hindsight, me being married to my husband, I understand. And he's so happy now. He's in a relationship. But when you, at the time, I think we were very early 20s, 20, 21. Yeah, it was tough. You're like, why would, you know.
I just know what you're like, what you went through. Cause I had a high school sweetheart and I was 15 and it's just like, it's so fairy tale. Like everything you do is just like.
So intense.
I know, it's so intense.
Puppy
so,
love.
I love it actually.
Yeah, I miss it.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Cause now me and my missus is just like, we're just so grown up. Like it's just like.
It's so domestic.
Yeah.
What do you want for dinner?
Let's just go out and eat. Because
I don't know where you want to go. We always have this conversation.
Don't even buy presents for each other. But when it came to like, you know, when I was like really young, it was just like, oh, we'll think about every
it's
anniversary.
It's our 3-month anniversary.
Buy roses, turn up to surprise her, drive her everywhere. Now I'm just like, can you just take an Uber or a taxi somewhere? Like just, but yeah, you miss those moments, right?
I do miss it. Yeah. It's very nice.
So you didn't fight for it, but then obviously things worked out because you ended up working for CoinJar.
Yeah. And that's where I met my husband.
Right. Yeah. And then because this is not a podcast about Zoe's love story.
But funny.
People want to know.
Hey, no. If you want to go down that rabbit hole.
We can laugh about it now, right? I mean.
But things happen. Like I said, things happen for a reason. So you worked for CoinJar and then how did July sort of come into, was that July was right after that?
No.
Or you did a whole bunch of other things?
I did a whole bunch. So then I did the CoinJar thing and then I did the Nomad thing and then we broke up. Then I came back and then I took a couple of full-time roles. Always in tech. Mm-hmm. Always in tech. And then one night, my friend was like, hey, I'm going to be a speaker at this function and it's called Fuck Up Night. You should come and, you know, why don't you come and listen? And Fuck Up Night is like a community night where people come and speak about their biggest fuck up in their life.
Oh, cool.
So you have like two or three speakers. So my friend was speaking and so I went to support her and it was great. And one of the other speakers was Ethan, who is the founder of the July of July. And I didn't know he was speaking. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know anything about July. And it was very early days of the business. And this would have been 4 years ago. And when he finished speaking, I turned next door to my, I turned to my husband and I said, wow, that guy is like awesome.
I thought you were about to say, that guy's really fucked up.
No, I was like, oh my God. Like he's just, I feel like I'd be mates with him. Like, you know, when you, I was like, he's cool. Well, I would him. Like, yeah, like I get it. Like when he's so passionate about the business, it's contagious. And then Aaron was like, oh, you should talk to him. And I was like, nah, you know, that's luggage. I work in tech. So it's so funny because then a few months later, my friend was like, hey, like, he took a job at July and he was saying, you should chat to us. We're looking for marketers. And I said, I've never marketed physical products. I've only marketed tech. And it's just a different marketing stack that you're specialized in, as you guys know. And he said, why don't you just chat? And I said, oh, fine. Like I'll do a coffee. And so on a Saturday morning around the corner from here, we did a coffee. I met Richard and Aith. And it turned out to be a job interview.
That you didn't realize?
I didn't realize. I think, you know, naturally you start asking people what they do and
yeah.
that we got more and more deep, like deep into like, you know, the craft of marketing and what was involved and about their business. And I came away from it feeling really like invigorated. Like I have always loved founders. I love working for founders because the passion is so palpitating. Like it really drives you to go above and beyond and really challenges how far someone can get deep into your craft because there's a really big purpose and lots of passion. Anyway, so we came away from that and it wasn't really a clear outcome because I wasn't quite sure what kind of person I was still looking for and neither were they. Anyway, 6 months later, I signed the contract and I joined them. And it was a very, as a marketing manager, and it was a super steep learning curve. So that would have been 3 years and six, 7 months now, ago that I joined and it's been wild.
This is like the longest you've been with one organization as well.
Yes, yeah, okay. Really. Which is, yeah, and I love it. Like it is by far the best job I've ever had. And I could not have planned it. I didn't plan it.
And why is that? Why is it the best job?
The first thing is you work with people who are really passionate and people who are just people who are really good at their work. Our team is young, they're passionate, they're so determined and the product is great. The founders are amazing. I think that really matters because that's the day to day. And also when you join a startup and when it's on this insane growth trajectory, you're personal and professional development is just insane. Like I've learned what I feel is like a decade of skills and like experience stuffed into 3.5 years. And that's what I always say when I interview people. I say like, it's not going to be easy. Like startup life is quite chaotic, but you'll fit in like 5 years in a really like in 1 year sometimes because you're thrown into the deep end. It takes a very specific type of person to thrive in that environment. And often I find if they are the right person for it, it's crazy. Like you just, I find the job so rewarding because I have seen multiple people I've hired just like shoot through the roof with like how amazing they can perform in a startup environment. It's
I can relate and I'm sure
you
can
relate too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even with doing Levelation and stuff like that and like Viv's probably nodding in the background there, but like, cause we're technically small businesses, you know, Davey's been doing his business for 6-7 years.
We're technically startups.
We're technically startups in a lot of ways and it's just chaos. Like you said, it's crazy. It's so like, chaos.
Like what am I doing?
Like, yeah. Like one day, like we're doing this and it's happening, right? We're building a podcast studio and then like within like a few weeks, there's a podcast studio all of a sudden. So as soon as someone has an idea, you know, and then you've got the team, of course, who then have to execute on it. It's like very similar, I think.
Yeah. And the fact that we meet so many guys and it's like one big family and we're just growing together. That's the part where I can relate so much. It's like, you know, these guys that started with me and girls that started with me that they were just young people that didn't know what they wanted, but now they have such like strong passion about what they're trying to do and how many people they're impacting in terms of our clients. I know it's accounting, it's a bit boring, but
it matters.
It matters. And it changes a lot of people. And now I'm just like, wow, like we've got this one big family. We're growing so fast. Every year we're like close to doubling in size. And we've got all these new people, new faces. And now like the people that we've been working with for the last 5 years is like managing people, which I never would have thought that we would be doing.
Which is what you're doing now.
Yeah.
in a lot of ways. Yeah. You see yourself doing that back in the day? Like obviously going from marketing to like general manager.
I think I smashed a lot of self-limiting beliefs in this role, like Agilei. Yeah, I didn't see myself at this level. And it's quite sad to say, but actually there was one conversation I had with Richard and Aith, and it was both amazing, but also when I reflect, it's quite sad because they said to me, they're like, we sometimes feel like we see more potential in you than you see in yourself. Mm. And it was like, obviously that's very nice to hear because you're like, wow, my bosses believe in me so much. But personally, you're like, wow, I have been capping my own potential. Mm. And it's really, really sad. But it's a journey, right? And you just kind of try and smash more ceilings and smash the beliefs as you go on and on. And you're just like, look, let's just keep trying. Mm. But yeah, it is, managing people is really incredibly challenging. And I think you don't really know it until you get to it. So the team is now 35 full-time employees, but really it's including the casual retail staff, about 60 to 65. And I consider all of them under my care. And it is such a huge responsibility. A lot of people, when you're younger, you'll just flippantly say, oh, I'm going to manage people, like, because that's what you're meant. Like, you know, that's, I guess you think that that's really where you should be going. But when you actually do it, and if you want to do it well, the sense of responsibility can get really overwhelming. Like I find it really overwhelming because you always are trying to balance like all different priorities all at once, the business priorities. You're trying to be a great boss. You're trying to also care for them as people. And having the foresight of what's ahead for the business and the team and for them, especially if they're younger than you. So yeah, it's been incredibly challenging, but so rewarding, so rewarding.
Like for the limiting beliefs, because I kind of want to like dig into that a little bit, because I feel like a lot of Asians have that problem. I mean, 100%. That's not even an Asian problem, but it's like, you know, it's like a lot of people have that problem. But let's just talk it because we're talking the context of Asians as well. Like, why do you feel like, have you explored that a little bit about why you felt you had that limiting belief?
Yeah, where does that stem from?
Yeah.
Yes, I actually have. I spent a lot of time on this. And I think it is probably because my parents, well, so I'm Malaysian, I'm first generation. I came when I was 10 with my older brother and my parents. And my dad is an architect and he is like a professional and he went to uni. But I guess I didn't see a lot of people who, like women, Asian women, around me like succeed and be in management roles. I didn't see it.
Yeah.
So when you don't see something, you don't really know that it's possible. It takes someone with great observation and great, like you would be amazing to be able to think of that as a possibility without seeing it. Very imaginative person, right? So for me, I think that was really a big part. Like I hadn't seen it as a young person, but then when we migrated and I kind of traveled a bit more, I started to see more, right? You see more women in leadership roles. You see more women of color in leadership roles, which made a huge difference. And then you start to see younger women of color who look like me in leadership roles. And that is like how it started for me, being like, well, if she can do it, I can do it too, right? So that's like societally and like more conceptually how I broke that. But also I think culturally my parents perhaps did fall. I would say compared to your standard Asian parents, they're a lot more progressive, but they perhaps did encourage and kind of thought, had limited views of what success meant. And it wasn't until, and so, you know, when I was growing up, I had very conventional views, you know, you get a full-time job, you work for a very reputable company, you know, you do all the things, you get married, you have kids, and you don't do anything out of that very linear lifestyle. But and this is the beauty of having migrated here and kind of traveling and meeting more people, is you kind of understand that success means very different things to different people, and you can't just copy and paste. Mm-hmm. Like it's so deeply tied to who you are and what your values are. Mm-hmm. And it requires so much introspection for you to actually do it in a way that honors you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that I went through this whole journey about that, being like, well, what is it that I actually want? How do I achieve it? And it's been messy, but moving forwards always.
Did you, as in, well, when you say journey, did you actually have conversations? Did you sort of seek out help? Like, what were some of the things that you actually did?
It's a combination of a few things. So, great family, like supportive family, who would supportive family, very supportive husband, supportive friends, lots of reading and like Googling and kind of just exposing yourself to what's out there. And probably the clincher is doing therapy, which can absolutely change the game. Like, just learning how to reframe things properly changed the game for me. And it started off, to tie it all back together, when we broke up, when my husband and I broke up for that short time when we were dating, I couldn't get myself out of the emotions of the breakup. Like, I just couldn't step out of it, out of the emotion. And, you know, you can talk to friends and you can talk to family, but they have a very vested interest in your health and well-being. And they are also very invested in the relationship you have with them in continuing. So they're not going to be as brutally honest and approach the conversation with as much candor as a psychologist would, who is paid for your vested, like with you and you only in mind. They don't care if the relationship continues, really. Mm-hmm. And so I just had this, after we broke up, I was also going through a whole heap of stuff, as you do in your mid-20s, right? And I just went to once, I think after the first session, it was the first time I was like, I was very honest with her, and it was unbelievable. Just having an objective viewpoint. And I mean, I continually saw her to try and work through a few things, and unbelievable.
So that first session,
I felt it from the first session.
Right. What did, are you able to share what you sort of talked about or unpacked? Like, so what was the profound moments?
A lot of it actually, I had a really great childhood and amazing upbringing, like very stable, but it still kind of goes back to your upbringing. Like, I find it's the same as well with professional coaching. If you do it, which is a little different to psychologists, but they often go back to your childhood, and it always starts from that. And then it kind of goes through the most memorable and impactful memories that you have, and then what the meanings are that are attached to that. Mm-hmm. And then there's also things. So we worked through a lot of my assumptions and beliefs, what they were grounded in, mm-hmm. whether or not I still believed in it as an adult, and whether I wanted to take it into my life. Yeah. And we did a whole heap of other things too, right? Like, you know, learning to think for myself and process emotions. That was a big one. And I think actually now I have quite a few Asian friends, of course, and it seems to be a trend actually. And especially now when I'm seeing my friends have kids and they are reading these books to their children, it's like teaching them how to identify emotions.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So they're like,
I've got
they're
a 7-month-old right now.
Yeah.
So.
They have these books now to teach kids like how to identify what they're feeling and then to go deeper and explain and communicate that. I kind of had to do that as an adult. And I think, unfortunately, I still think a lot of people haven't done that before as adults. So we did that huge exercise of being like, well, what, like, can you identify the emotion? Because I think when I was in my 20s, the only emotions I could really identify were like, I'm sad, I'm happy, and I'm angry.
Yeah.
But really, there's a lot more. This is just a huge spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. There's this thing called the feelings wheel, which is, you kind of identify which emotion, you start with one and then it kind of encourages you to go like, let's go further. Like, okay, well, if you're angry, why are you angry? Like, okay. Are you frustrated?
Oh, okay. What kind of angry are you?
Right.
And by working that out, you can work out how to solve it. Is that what you mean?
Well, by working, I guess, a lot of it, and I'm still working on it, right? Yeah. Like, it's still a continual thing where you try and identify the emotion. I think the general sentiment is you try and spend more time figuring out like why you feel it. Mm-hmm. It's less about solving it. And I think the key perhaps in solving it is delving deeper into why. So philosophical. Oh my gosh.
That's interesting. Cool. I love this. No, it's interesting. That's why I'm asking.
Well, I guess when I was younger, you know, like you're, especially if you're first generation, like going to a psych is very like, taboo.
Yeah.
But I don't know. To me,
I don't even know if it's taboo. I just don't know people even think about
it. It's not a thing. Yeah,
it's not a thing, but it should be, because you go to a doctor when you're sick, or you go to a physio when you feel like your muscle's not working. And if you're stuck mentally on a problem, just go to a person who specializes in fixing that problem. Why would you torture yourself, right? I mean, I understand actually, like, it is, it's actually quite expensive, and they are very busy now, especially after COVID. But if you can, it's fantastic, because you kind of shortcut your way through it, and you it's amazing, right?
Right. Think about it. If you are mentally struggling and you're not, what's going to happen? You're going to be inefficient. You're not going to be able to do what you need to do. You're probably even going to cause problems in your relationships that you have with people. You could even lose your job. And if you just went and saw someone and that could help you faster, then you can go back to your everyday life.
I personally see it as, it's not even when you have a problem, it's also like every milestone that you achieve, it's going to change your life. And there's so much richness that you can unpack about yourself in these moments. Like, you know, when you get married, when you have a child, if you go through a divorce, if you go through a breakup, if you have a friendship that is like deteriorating, if work is like freaking you out and you're, you know, I know they're kind of all problems, but some not, right? Like,
it's a good and bad.
It is like, it is a missed opportunity to learn more about yourself. It depends on your philosophy in life, but I think, you know, why would you miss out on this richness of learning more about yourself in really like intense moments of your life and milestones?
This episode is sponsored by Millon Wines. Millon Wines are an award-winning family-owned winery located in the renowned wine regions of Barossa Valley, Eden Valley and Clare Valley, presenting a fusion of vineyards that seamlessly infuse new technologies with old world traditions. Their vineyards capture the essence of each region, delivering distinctive wines with complex flavour profiles in small batches, a minimalistic approach that allows the fruit to speak for itself. Explore their range at www.millonwines.com.au. Now back onto the episode.
There's something magical about helping yourself through conversation, because it's like, if you don't talk about it, like, you might have it swimming in your head, but it's like the act of actually having the conversation about it helps a lot. Because I find myself sometimes, like, we talk about it, and sometimes before we even let the other person respond, we already sort of like solved the problem in a lot of ways, or we sort of know why. And when you were saying this, and I've been actually thinking about, I don't see a therapist, but I've been thinking about it. Just because I give you an example. So, and I think a lot of like male Asians can probably relate. I don't know if your parents were like this, right? Which is the, especially Chinese, I used to get told this, and I love my parents. This is all they knew, but I used to, like, you know, if you cry as a kid, you know, and this was like, whether you were like, you know, sort of under 10 or even just, you know, in high school. And I used to get told, you're like, basically in Chinese is like, you're a male, like you're a guy, boys don't cry. Like, yeah. Used to get that kind of response, right? And because you're a child, all you know is like, that's fact. Mm. But what it does do is it causes you to sort of bury or internalize your emotions. And then it's the recognition issue of not knowing how to deal with your emotions when they do come up every now and again. Because it's actually in my opinion, it's an unhealthy thing to not be able to identify your emotions and then be able to do something about it.
Yes.
And I think that comes with, at least from an Asian experience, shame. Because it's like, all right, well, if I'm a guy and I cry, it's a very shameful thing to do.
Yeah.
And then it's a problem, right?
Why are you looking at me?
Because he's cried a fair bit.
No. It's because it's just in the last month, it's been very emotional. I've been getting married and, you know, I've been crying a lot. We had our 1 year anniversary. But I kind of used to not cry that much. I don't know what's going on.
I think you're just becoming more in tune. It's good.
Yeah, I think it's good.
There's a lot more clarity. Anyway, my point of that is I now struggle with, and I say this as well, it's like I'm quite guarded about these types of emotions, right? Like, yeah. I can feel it, but it's like quite hard for me to just like tip over the edge and like say, for example, cry or feel like very strong emotions. And so like I've been almost in certain ways growing up being trained to be more stoic. But because of that, great for leadership, because it's like when shit hits the fan, I'm just like, you know, sort of like zoned in. I know what to do. But for like more emotional, like, let's just talk your personal relationships or, you know, life events that happen that are a big deal, it's like I'm always sort of like the don't get too high, don't get too low type thing. Yeah. I don't know what you guys think.
I'm going to challenge you there.
Yeah.
Is it really good for leadership?
Well, that's the thing. So that's the assumption. And this goes into, this is such a therapy session, but yeah.
It's so good. Okay. So in the challenging thing, I think you can be both emotionally in tune and emotionally intelligent and mm-hmm. stoic at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that I learned, because my assumption growing up was if you cry and you show strong displays of emotion, you're weak and you are vulnerable.
Correct.
That flipped on its head when I got married, and my husband, who is very emotionally intelligent and very in tune with his emotions, say it's actually stronger for you to face your emotions head on.
Right. It's not the absence of it.
It's your ability to just process them and be brave about it. And actually it's so Asian for me to say this. It's so efficient. Because otherwise you'll have to deal with it like maybe 5-10 years down the track.
Yeah, and it's all just more get it up, done basically.
Now and the other thing that helped me a lot is you don't have to do it publicly, it's you can still do this very privately at home in journals or with very close friends or just with your partner or with a psych. You don't actually, no one needs to know. So if you're still really weird about the shame thing, you can just process it privately. Mm. But does it help you be a great leader? Yes. Is it necessary? Yes. Is it common? No. Mm. And I think this is where I get really passionate about people who are emotionally intelligent people leading, because I think that's what makes a really good leader and a really good manager, is like you have the ability to be empathetic, but beyond that, also help people navigate really challenging situations at work.
Mm. Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is also like, what's the definition of I feel like the definition of leadership in sort of the stereotype, like Western society, is sort of like the loud, sort of like extroverted, you know, like that classic type leader. And I think like quiet leadership is something that could be quite different. It should in a certain way be normalized, because thinking about say females or, you know, people of color and things like that, where we probably aren't that type, we are much more analytical, we're more reserved, we sit back and we observe, we look at situations and then decide what to do about them, is again could be perceived as either weak or passive or whatever the label is. Mm. What are your thoughts on that in terms of like leadership styles?
I actually don't have a super strong opinion on it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think everyone has their own style. Mm-hmm. And the best thing is if you find yourself working in an environment where the style works for the team,
mm-hmm.
that's, to me, that's the only
thing. So it's to each their own again.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and yeah. I think generally having diverse ways of leading is now very widely accepted and encouraged. So it's funny. Yeah. I never saw it the way that you just did, like what you just said. I don't even consider that.
Well, the reason why I say that is because I did corporate for such a long time. Yeah. I was never in startups, for example, where I feel like maybe startups was a little bit more progressive, where you're working very closely with the founder. But you know, classic corporate there was like your A type leadership. And often in my experience with many people, it was middle-aged, white or Caucasian male leadership. And it was very defined a certain way it was. And when you're, say, Asian and probably not that interested in what they're interested in, that sort of stuff, and I've talked about this many times on the podcast, it's like, does that mean that I'm not leadership material?
Yeah.
You know, you start to question that, and then it goes back to the self-limiting beliefs.
Yeah, and also like seeing what you want to be, like seeing yourself, seeing a version of yourself.
Yeah, because there was no one doing it.
Yeah, strong leadership is kind of like what you see in the army, right? Like you got this strong white male with power that's commanding over people and yelling real hard at people and not being weak. And that's kind of like moved into, they use that a bit in corporate as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm starting to talk to the younger generation, and I've hired, I'm not really younger generation. I am the younger generation. So I'm starting to understand that doesn't really work with us.
That's what I mean.
We're so much more in tune with our emotions, and we need people to be more emotional. We need leaders to understand and know what we're going through for us to respect them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you haven't been what we've been through. Even though I know it's been harder for you when you're older, or what you went through, when you were younger and what you went through in your generation, they need to understand what we're going through for us to respect them and lead them. And that's what I've noticed about the people I've worked with. And that's why I think, and that's why I challenge you, because I don't think a leader should be just strong and, you know, not being in tune with the emotions with their team. I think you need to understand emotions, and what you can say impacts them. It doesn't always have to be.
Oh, look, I get what you're saying. Maybe I said it wrong, but I was like, I was saying leadership in the sense that, like, when shit hits the fan.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
You don't want to be the one fucking screaming with your hair on fire as well. Like, you kind of, people are looking to someone to steer the ship. They're looking for a leader to clarify, you know, but you can still be emotionally in tune and that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm sure things go wrong in July all the time being a startup, but you know, the thing is, like, the question that comes to my head is, you said, Rich and Nath actually believed more in you than you believed in yourself at the time. What was it that they saw in you? Did they tell you what they saw in you? And you were like, holy shit.
I think they saw a lot of leadership and ability to set up processes and set up people for success. Yeah. And I think that that's really what I'm good at. Like, I really love doing that, like setting people up and then kind of just letting them run. Mm-hmm. And it's worked really well. It's been quite rewarding. Mm.
Would you say that you're very much aligned with the culture in July?
Yes, I think so. So there's a few of us have been with the business for quite a long time, and we never really like did it deliberately, but we just have this culture that we've kind of carried on from the start. Mm-hmm. And we haven't even done like any exercises on naming it. We kind of just know what it is. It's really weird. Yeah. And so when you find out about these corporate businesses that have like these like values and things like that, I find it really funny because I did have a little taste of it, but to me, it's such an organic, soft skill thing that when you go through this like really weird workshops and exercises to try and name it, you might lose its specialness.
Yeah.
Obviously this is like, we're still a really small team, so we can get away with it. But I understand as you get older, you need systems in place things.
Yeah.
I think we're in agreement. Yeah. Like, your thoughts are like, doing the exercise is weird.
It's really weird.
I find it strange. Yeah. Our
values?
I did a manager strategy day a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago. And I was so weirded out by it because I think for us, and I, the reason why I asked you that, I think you're very aligned with, are you aligned with the culture? And I kind of understand what your founders believe seeing you. Because there's this lady that works with me, her name's Lisa. And she is, I call her the mother hen. And when I hired her, we were out and about, you know, at a rave, guys. We were at a rave. And then I said to her.
In case you missed it.
I just want people to know because it's a funny story. And I just said, I want to hire you. And I want you as my office admin. And at that time, we only had like 3 people. So you don't really need an office admin. But I just knew that there's so much potential in her because she is going to, like, I don't have the mental capacity when I'm running a business, looking at the numbers and all that stuff, to deal with the culture of the business. And when I'm growing this thing and where it's all about people and people that's going to drive these things into, like, you know, 10 times, and because it's startup, I need someone to care about us, not just the staff, but also me. I need to rely on this person just to talk to when things are going wrong in the business and just steer me in line and go, you know, David, it's okay, it's fine. Yeah. And I think I can see that in you. I've only met you for like half an hour, but I could see that. And when your founders, when you said stuff about like how your founder saw potential in you, and I could kind of see that. And what you're saying right now, it's all about people. You've realized that everything about what you're saying right now is all about the relationships and the people that you have. Yeah, so I think that you're a big thing about the culture. If you were disappearing out of July, the culture will go down completely. Yeah.
I think it's for a lot of them. Yeah, a lot of our senior team, they are the backbone of the business and they form the culture. And it's we've done a really good job.
Yeah. Like, and is it weird that like you just set the culture? Like you just go, oh, this is our culture.
I think it's perfectly. Oh, no, I find that weird.
Yeah, that's strange.
It's really weird.
Other way.
Yeah.
You know, you just do. And then as you do, you form culture because it's with this weird, I don't know, like symbiotic don't know, like
it's creative, it just happens. It's creative within the organization.
Yeah, because so. It's what you do, it's what you say, it's yeah. like all the actions that you take. It's not like a, here's this poster of our values and it's like an acronym that turns into a word, like that kind of really corporate buzz. I always found that really strange, but then to your point, you're like, well, maybe large organizations have a different problem. Mm-hmm. But I actually still think it's the same thing because it starts with the leadership. And then all the people who set the standards and it set the expectations around how we do things should be the culture. Mm. It's not about saying, oh, have we hit these marks? It's like a checklist. It's like a thing that you tick off the list. So I don't think it matters whether the organization is large or small. It's just harder when it's larger.
So much harder.
So much harder, right?
Yeah.
And you gotta have the right people in place. And then it goes back to like people and goes back to like the leadership and the seniors and things like that. I would argue like some of my guys, like if they leave the business, like maybe the culture is going to change for sure. You know, and then you have to, it's on you to keep everyone accountable as well.
We have very clear things that we look for in interviews, which help us to foster and protect the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first thing that we always look at, and we've been following this and it actually does work, is problem solving skills. So that's like the number one thing. Are they the type of person that's going to Google something or will they ask you what's this, right?
Mm.
So are they the type of person where if you give them a problem that's in their skill set and their arena, they will like find that quite interesting and then they'll kind of pull that thread. If they don't show that spark or that interest and the eagerness to solve a problem that's relevant in their field, it's a huge red flag for me because you kind of need that in a hustle bustle startup like ours. The other thing is a lot of people do this is just, do they pass a beer test? As in, would you actually enjoy having a beer with them one-on-one for like more than 30 minutes? Like, would you say this is the biggest strainer or like this is actually quite fun?
Yeah, right.
And you have to be careful with how you assess that. You have to assess it fairly, assess it with a, you know, there is a rigor around how we do that.
Mm.
But we follow it quite tightly. And also just kind of, because we are a design-based business and we're very product-focused, do these people actually care about design?
Yeah.
So you could be hiring an accountant who would just be looking at our numbers, but we would still be like, do they have an appreciation for the design?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like those three things, the problem-solving one being major, has helped us like to go from 10 to 30 to now 60 with relatively quite few issues.
I reckon Ken would fail the beer test because he doesn't drink alcohol anymore.
Sorry, a coffee quit test. Alcohol.
The coffee
good.
Test.
That's good. That's even better. That means if he said yes, he'd be like, he doesn't even need alcohol. He's that cool. He's that exciting. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you in terms of the recruitment process. Besides obviously the, you know, you call them the hard skills, it's the technical skills. It is, for me, is all cultural fit. Like in many ways. And I don't know how to define that. I'm definitely not as rigorous as you guys are with that.
It's still a process though.
But yeah, it's like a innate thing in a lot of ways. You do interviews with people and you just, there's something clicks, something you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to, and I feel like some of the worst recruitment decisions I've made in my life are usually when I trust my head too much and not enough in the gut.
Yes.
Like it's like a feeling that you have after the interview and you're like, yep, this person might on paper or say the right things and you're like, technically they can do the job. But then there's something about them that's off and you're like, well, I'm not sure if they'd be a good fit. And then you go ahead and you've recruited them anyway and it never works out.
I actually don't really look at the problem solving skill that much, but maybe it's because I rely on the managers to work that out.
To vet that out.
Yeah, but I also, maybe that's to my detriment. I don't think I'm a good person at hiring. I think I'm terrible.
He's definitely a terrible hirer. Yeah.
because it's all about culture. And if
he won't say this, but he's actually a very he sees a lot of good in people.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm the same.
Yeah. So he's always like, you got potential.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think the generosity tends to overextend. That gets himself into trouble.
Yeah. The managers kind of don't like me interviewing people at all. And because I'm just like, you're hired.
Straight away. You want money on a job, I gotcha.
How much money you want?
You know what it is? You're just very optimistic and you think the best of everyone. And there's far more benefit to that than negative. But the negative, I mean, as long as you bolster yourself with people who can watch out for that, it's not really a problem, right?
So we've got this rule where like I'm not allowed to have the first interview. Like not allowed.
Oh, it's actually a rule now.
Well, they don't let me do it because if like, I do it, I'll hire them straight away. Yeah. So it unfortunately happened in like the last couple of months because everyone was busy and I'm like, yep, I'm hiring this person. Done. We're done. And we're through this process. They were like, Davey, did you offer him the job already? Yeah. So anyway.
Well, I mean, the other thing I wanted to ask you was really, there was a particular note in here where you said three Asian women came to you at a conference where you were a panelist. And they said they were very inspired, I guess, by you. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's because seeing you as a female leader, you know, on stage, was that sort of the context behind it?
As a, like an Asian female. Yeah. Yes. It's actually happened a few times since then.
And you said you didn't know how to process it.
Yeah. It was quite a shock, I guess, because I don't actually see myself, like I always forget that I'm Asian. That sounds so strange, but I guess I have trained myself to not think about it as a thing. That's one thing that makes me, and in a professional setting, I have taught myself to be like, that's not, like people don't look at that, like you don't look at that. You determine your success on merit. Like, you know, it's, I don't know, like it just kind of happened. And so when I do a few speaking events or like in anything in a professional capacity, I kind of forget about it in a way. And I think it was just that it was three of them. They came up to me and they were like, it's so nice to see. They literally said something like, you're so nice to see an Asian woman on stage. Mm. And it just, I was so taken aback because I was like, wow. Yeah, I forget that that's how people see me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, wow, like, I was very touched because I was like, it's meaningful for them. I should actually remind myself that I have the capacity to inspire in this way. In a way, I had been neglecting that. I you're so focused on your work. You kind of forget that we go around full circle now where I am that person that can have the power to inspire others, being like, yes, you're young, you're Asian, you're female, you can do it. And it was just really, it was really touching. And it kind of, at that time, I'm so busy, like the business is growing so fast and I had considered pulling back on a lot more like speaking ops because I was like, I really want to be with the team. Mm. But I guess now I still do them and I'm far more selective because it's if it's just one person that's like, oh my God, like that's amazing, like an Asian woman on stage, why not, right? That's me, the younger version of me.
Yep.
And in a way, like as a person, and if you become more and more successful and you're a leader, it's kind of not your responsibility, but it's actually one of the privileges that you have to inspire others in a position of leadership.
Mm. But then you see it, like, if remember how you mentioned that you had these limiting beliefs.
Yes.
And if you were younger and you saw, you know, Asians on stage doing all that stuff and starting businesses, then you would be like, okay, yeah, I can do it too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why. And I agree, like, 100% that I was, like, oblivious to it too. I didn't even think about it at all. I was just – and when you were telling the story about how, like – you wanted to work in startup and you love the hustle and bustle of startup. I'm like, wow. Like I didn't even realize that I did the exact same thing too. Like I'm 26 starting an accounting firm. And at that time, like I never really met an Asian running a business in accounting. Mm. Like where I worked, like all the connections I made, there was no Asian partners or bosses in like big four accounting firms that I knew of. So I was one of the first that did it. And I was like, what the heck? How did I decide to do that? I just went for it. I didn't even think about it. I was oblivious that I was Asian.
I love that.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. I'm just going to do it, thinking I could do it because I thought I could do a better job.
Yeah.
So I just went.
It wasn't because you were Asian.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it at all.
Yeah. And then you kind of like reminded of it.
Yeah.
Like, and especially now.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Look, I'm not like trying to talk myself up, but like I won this award and I was going up to stand there to give the speech and I was like, holy crap, I'm like the only Asian, one of the only Asians that received an award tonight.
Like, it hits you sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing though, because it's especially in moments like that, you're so proud. You're like, you know. Yeah.
Especially at events. I feel like events have this thing.
Yeah.
Because you actually physically see who's in the room.
Yeah.
And maybe the diversity or lack of diversity sometimes.
Yeah.
And it hits you.
Yeah. And you're like, I'm the only Asian person here.
Yeah,
sometimes I'm the only young Asian woman or young a woman.
Elements, right?
It's quite intense. But you just got to reframe it and be like, that's right. Like, instead of, oh my gosh, I'm the only one. It's, yeah, that's right. That's why it's even more important.
You should be here.
This is why even more important for me to be here, right? I'm still going through that journey. It's quite nice because I do feel like it's special when you have moments like that. It reminds you of your ability to inspire. It's really, really nice and meaningful.
And then the other aspect of being Asian was that TV show Pachinko.
And book, actually.
Well,
it's originally
it became a TV show, right? On Apple TV, right? And you said you got really emotional, you know, sort of consuming that.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yes. So I read Pachinko. I think it might have been during lockdown. And Pachinko is written by a Korean author who Lee Min-jin, and she is a lawyer. And I think she spent about a decade, if I'm not wrong, writing this book. And it is essentially a historical fiction saga, like epic. It goes through three generations of a Korean family. Like, it really impacted me reading it because I'm a huge reader of fiction, and it was just one of the first times where I was like, wow, I feel so seen. This is so nice. Like, this is an Asian family. Like, I'm not Korean, but man, there's so much that I can relate to here. The themes, I guess the themes that the author touched on throughout the whole book were so vivid and relevant to me as a person. And you don't really get that in a lot of books. And it was multiple things. So it was like the themes that she touched on, the fact that it was multi-generational. So as a migrant, I really was like, wow, like, you know, the themes that came out from that. And she's just an excellent writer, obviously. So you just experience a full spectrum of emotions. And it's really, I count us as really lucky to be living in the time that we're living in, because we're seeing more and more of us in mainstream media, right? Like, even if you take Bridgerton, for example, you know, the newest season is just like, it's just a standard plot and not written for a minority, but played by South Asians.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Like, but they're not fixated on the fact that they're South Asians. They're just normal people, which is how I think we should be represented. Like, we're people first, you know. You see a lot of, there's so many Asian actors like killing it right now. Like, it's pretty sensational. And I think more and more of that is just going to help our next generations of Asians feel so empowered and just kind of achieve.
It's like that that movie on Netflix, Beef, when we watched it. Like, it was so relatable, right? Everything about it was like, you know, the
phone call with the dad.
Yeah.
Do you know, with the phone call with the dad and the brothers in the back? Do you know, in the first, it was just quite funny.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's also like just the anger and the negative parts of it as well, the mental illnesses and
or even the relationship with his parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many awkward moments.
I don't want to work anymore. Like, things like that, you know?
Yeah. And the sibling love and relationships that they have, the stuff that they do to each other. It's just everything about it was so bloody relatable to not just Asian Australians or Asian Americans, but pretty much every Asian out there. So yeah, I just loved it. I loved it so much. Right?
And like, it's like one of those things where you catch yourself, you're going like, why am I emotional about this thing? Because it's like, you're like, finally, because you come to the realization that you're like, I've been consuming such maybe westernized media for such a long time that I think that's the norm. And all of a sudden there's something that's like super relatable when you see stories play out that you're like, oh, this happens in my family or this happens in my life. And you're like, holy shit, there's like people out there who actually go through the same thing as you do. And maybe it's the realization going that, oh, I'm not the only one potentially going through it, that you come to that sort of realization, just like everything else that we talked about, which is like, you know, being a leader, you know, all of the bloody trauma and all the issues that we have. Overall.
No, I was just like, so this is how it feels to watch, you know, movies that relate to you.
Yes, that's what I felt too. Yeah. Like, oh my God, is this what you guys
everyone else is crying.
Things?
You're like, why am I not crying?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, because it's not relatable.
Yeah. It's so insane, right?
Yeah.
Do you get that when you go back to Malaysia? Like, just seeing things and you're just like.
Oh, all the time. I had tried to go back a couple of times, right?
Yeah.
I love being here and Australia is amazing, but I have always felt like, you know, there's still a part of me back in Malaysia, even though I left when I was like 9.
Which is still a decent time.
Yeah, but you know.
A third of your life.
Yeah, I still feel not quite fully home here sometimes, mm-hmm. In Australia only. And I don't actually, I still don't really know why. But when I go back, I feel really like, oh. But I still feel, it's such a third culture thing, right? Yeah, like third culture kid thing. I go back, I still don't feel like I fit in there in Malaysia either. Mm. But yeah, there's just different versions of home.
Yeah, I feel that way. Yeah. I go back to China and I say this all the time. I'm like, there's something comforting about going, like stepping out of the airport and then like everyone has the same habits as you. Everyone looks similar to either you or your family or your friends. And the mannerisms, like probably the, as an example, like even just buying something from the store or even how you... Because I've always been taught to like, doesn't matter who it is, someone who's older than you, it's like uncle, auntie.
Yeah.
Like the sort of the etiquette, which you don't get in Western society, you call everyone by their first names, right? I really love that stuff because I think it's just a form of not just respect, but also just like a term of endearment when you spend time
and
with people.
And it's so special to the culture.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly.
We have that, you know, it's really nice.
Yeah, and there's like some sort of pulling power there.
It's cool that you guys have it. For me, I don't know if I have it because my parents are born in Vietnam, but they're Chinese.
I think you might, and maybe it's just a thought, you might need to go back to China where your parents are from to truly experience.
But they don't, they don't talk to me about that stuff. Yeah. So the problem with my heritage is that it's cut off. They've cut it off. And I don't know why.
As in they just don't talk past a certain point.
Yeah.
In the past. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
it's really traumatic for them, probably.
Like there was wars. There's reasons why they left.
Mm. Yes.
You know, China, they left China. Well, our grandparents left China because of a war in China.
Mm.
And they went to Vietnam. And my parents left Vietnam because of a war. And the crazy thing about this is that when I go back to Vietnam, my parents don't want me to meet my relatives.
Why?
Because of the trauma that they've been through and the things that like happened since then.
They don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. So, and I'm sure some families go through this and that's probably why I want to talk about it. Yeah. So it's so hard for us. And I kind of miss that. I want that.
Yeah.
Want what you guys are talking about.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily war, but certainly I don't think my parents don't, I don't know about your parents, but my parents don't really talk about anything beyond my grandparents. Like I don't know much beyond my grandparents.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. I don't even know anything beyond beyond my parents in Vietnam.
But I feel like that's all the more reason to then explore. Like I've got this sort of yearning to go back and actually explore my roots and trace the
I do
back.
Too. I do too.
Right?
I just think I need more headspace to do it. That's just
oh yeah.
Because like there was just so many things. And Vin, we had a chat to Vin. Do you know who Vin is?
No, but I've seen a lot of content with him.
Yeah, so he's Vietnamese as well. And he was he told a story where his dad is such a good-hearted man because he was giving money back always, constantly.
Yeah.
Like even if the family didn't have much. The thing is, in some Asian families is that when they give money back, and our parents did the same, that it feels like it was taken for granted, and that's what causes problems within the relationship. And that's where my parents are worried that I have to go through that as well. And so then, hence why they just say, "Davey, I don't think it's a good idea. Like maybe it's not a good idea. I just want you to know them, but not know them, because if you know them,
like have a relationship.
Yeah, because it could come to you now. They could be coming to you.
Oh, I see.
And then it's just like this weird relationship we have now. So I want to go back and I want to like, you know, visit that and like try to find my heritage and know those stories or how my parents grew up. And I see all these photos in the albums and I just want to look at it and just go, oh, I want to know what that story that my parents have.
Mm.
But I'm scared of trying. But you know, one day.
You don't know what's there.
Yeah. And I think I need the mental capacity and headspace to do it. Yeah. So that's why
What about Malaysia? Like, I mean, how's the family situation play out over there? Like, you just got extended relatives there.
Mm. I have extended relatives, my mom's side, my dad's side. And we still stay in touch. We still talk to them. Mm. It's quite common for them to send their children or for families to migrate to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, we still stay quite close. My dad goes, my parents go back really often.
Mm.
I try and go back as often as I can. I'm very fortunate because I don't think, we probably did go through wars, but not in my parents didn't go through that, and I certainly haven't. Yeah, so we've healed from that trauma, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, but yeah, I do really like going back. And I think if I can say, I would say a lot of people, especially first generation migrants, like when they come to Australia, you're forced to assimilate, otherwise you get bullied. So you kind of, for some time, it's quite normal for a lot of children to shed their Asianness. Mm. You kind of deny it completely. And I think it's really sad, but like quite common. And sometimes I've observed in friends that they just haven't come around back to it and acknowledged and embraced it.
Yep.
And I really think, I mean, it's not for me to say, but I found a lot from actually doing that myself, being like, no, like, you know, my Malaysian roots are actually really important. Like it's formed the foundation of who I am.
Of course, when you want to have kids as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll probably ask that question.
I think about the impact.
Yeah. And it's not so much family. Yeah, family's huge, but it's mostly like just the culture. Like what are the hallmarks of a Malaysian culture, right? Food is huge for most cultures and most Asian cultures. But like, what about the food? What, you know, it's interesting to kind of go deeper and deeper into it.
I guess the last question I had was just really around advice, you know, for people who might be aspiring to do something either similar to you or sort of see themselves in you. So much like, you know, sort of the Asian women who approached you at these conferences and things like that. So do you have sort of any like words of wisdom, any advice for anyone like that?
One of the themes I guess we covered is the fact that a lot of everything in my life hasn't felt very linear or very conventional at all. And I think a lot of that is being quite opportunistic. So there's two elements to this, right? It's firstly developing an attitude of being opportunistic and saying yes to things and like exploring how things can look in different things, like in different ways, on different paths, how your life can change. And so that's the first thing. So stay open to opportunities. Don't just believe that things have to be linear and conventional. Explore and investigate. The second thing is, and I found this really helpful in my 20s, is see your life in decades, not in years. I mean, you underestimate how much you can achieve in a decade and you overestimate how much you can achieve in a year. And I think when you see your life in decades, we're in our 30s, I think you're, we're in our 30s, so you're actually kind of not even halfway there.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild. I feel like I've done a lot, but you're actually not even halfway there. Like I'm
50.
Yeah, you know.
I feel like I'm just getting started.
And so you really got to, I guess it gives you so much perspective, like how to make decisions and also the weight that you give to your decisions. Mm. Like you often give it too much weight to decisions. You think that your like life's gonna get ruined if you screw this decision up. Mm. Actually, probably not. Mm. You know, so like kind of step back a bit and give you a bit of perspective if you look at things in a decade. And then sorry, that's the second thing. So first thing was being very opportunistic and open-minded. Second thing was think of your life in decades, not years. And then the third thing I found, especially recently, is the importance of momentum. Mm-hmm. It can work both ways, positively and negatively. Sometimes you just need a break. So if you're going through a bad patch, you want to force yourself to have a win, even if it's small, and then try and get the momentum for good things to continue to happen.
Right.
And a lot of that is like mindset, right? Mm. So you can just keep bringing good things. Everyone has different ways of doing this, but you need to find a way to, just cut the negative negativity, especially if you're finding that the negativity is gaining momentum. There's a lot of bad shit happening.
Yeah.
You know, you might be very spiritual and go and do something about that in that way, but yes, you might have more physical ways of like other ways of doing it. And it's also the positive side. If you're having lots of wins, keep it up and be really conscious that you've gotten momentum, and to keep going and keep fostering it and don't stop, essentially. So yeah, that's changed my life, having that attitude.
Excellent. You got anything else you want to
say? That's really great words of wisdom.
Yeah, I love that last one particularly. Because it's like, I think you sometimes, we sometimes get...
It's a circuit breaker. Cliche. That's what it's called.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. Like,
circuit break, yeah.
You know, sort of just cut it off before it sort of rips in and becomes, you know, too much as well. And I was going to say, like, a lot of advice sometimes can be quite cliche, but that was something I've never heard of before. Which is amazing. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
If people want to connect with you, what's the best way to connect with you?
Probably on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn?
Yeah.
Zoe Lowe on LinkedIn.
DM me. Yeah.
DM, slide into DMs.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Thanks for coming on the show, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Zoe.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. A lot of work and effort goes into Level Asian with a whole team behind the scenes. While we aren't looking for anyone to pay for this content, what helps the podcast grow, reach more people, and benefit more Asians around the world is if you could leave a 5-star review if you're on Spotify, Apple, Google, or any other audio platforms. And leave us a like, comment, and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Catch you on the next episode.